Rule 9. If old memories still upset you, write them down carefully and completely. But is yesterday finished with you? Imagine you undertook some truly terrible actions in the past. You betrayed or hurt people in a genuinely damaging manner. You damaged their reputation with gossip and innuendo. You took credit for their work. You robbed them materially or spiritually. You cheated on them. Or imagine, instead, that you have been the target of some such events. And let us also assume you have become wise enough to try to avoid repeating the experience. In both circumstances, as perpetrator or victim, the actual events and the associated memories evoke fear, guilt, and shame. Why? In the first case, you have betrayed yourself. You did not play the medium to long-term game properly and are suffering the consequences. You are not the sort of person other people choose to have around. You might not even be the sort of person you want to have around. In the second case, you were badly mistreated by someone else. In some real sense, however, it does not matter whether you were suffering because of self-betrayal or at the hands of others. What does matter is that you do not desire any recurrence. Now, if you recall the memory, or if it comes back unbidden, complete with terror, shame, and guilt, this means something specific. It means that you fell into a hole, a pit, more accurately, or were pushed there, and that is not good. But what is worse is that you do not know why. Perhaps you trusted other people too easily. Perhaps you were too naive. Perhaps you were willfully blind. Perhaps you encountered genuine malevolence on the part of another or yourself, and that is the worst situation, and the one most difficult to overcome. But at one level of analysis, whether you fell or were pushed makes little difference, not to the emotional systems that have emerged over the course of evolution and now serve to protect you. They care about one thing and one thing only, that you do not repeat a mistake. The alarms those systems activate are fear-based. That is too weak a phrase. Terror-based is more accurate, the kind of terror limited to neither time nor place. And all they care about is reminding you of the still extant danger. A part of reality, and a perilous part, has remained unmapped, low resolution, lacking sufficient detail, and so is a part of you. You are not sharp, alert, dangerous, wary, wise, or kind enough, who knows, so that the terror systems protecting you are confident in your ability to wend your way successfully through the same maze if it once again manifests itself in front of you. Learn from the past, or repeat its horrors in imagination endlessly. Frequently, people do not so much repress the terrible things that happened in the past as refuse to think them through, pushing them out of their mind or occupying themselves with other activities. They have their reasons. And sometimes traumatized people appear literally unable to understand what befell them. It can be prohibitively difficult for abused children, for example, to generate a worldview philosophically sophisticated enough to span the full spectrum of human motivation. They simply cannot understand why someone might torment them physically or abuse them sexually. If they are young enough, it is likely that they do not even explicitly comprehend what is happening. Comprehending such matters is exceptionally challenging, even for adults. But in some unfortunate and arguably unjust sense, it does not matter. Refusal or inability both leave a geographic area in memory, unexplored, active, and rife with danger. It is a psychological truism that anything sufficiently threatening or harmful once encountered can never be forgotten if it has never been understood. To orient ourselves in the world, we need to know where we are and where we are going. Where we are. That concept must optimally include a full account of our experience of the world to date. If you do not know what roads you have traversed, it is difficult to calculate where you are. Where we are going. That is the projection of our ultimate ideal, by no means simply a question, say, of accomplishment, love, wealth, or power, but development of the character that makes all fortunate outcomes more likely and all unfortunate outcomes less likely. We map the world so that we can make the move from where we are, from point A, to where we are going, to point B. We use our map to guide our movement, and we encounter successes and obstacles along the way. The successes are both confidence-building and exhilarating. Not only are we moving toward our ultimate desire, we appear to be doing so properly, and are therefore not only moving ahead, but validating our map. The obstacles and failures are, by contrast, anxiety-provoking, depressing, and painful. They indicate our profound ignorance. They indicate that we do not understand with sufficient depth where we have been, where we are, or where we are going. They indicate that something we have built with great difficulty and wish above all to protect is flawed, to a degree both serious and not fully understood. We must recollect our experiences and derive from them their moral. Otherwise, we remain in the past, plagued by reminiscences, tormented by conscience, cynical for the loss of what might have been, unforgiving of ourselves, and unable to accept the challenges and tragedies facing us. We must recollect ourselves or suffer in direct proportion to our ignorance and avoidance. We must gather everything from the past that we avoided. We must rekindle every lost opportunity. We must repent for missing the mark, meditate on our errors, acquire now what we should have acquired then, and put ourselves back together. And I am not saying this is always possible. I have seen people so lost that there was not enough spark left to survive. The person in the present had been rendered too insignificant to confront in his or her current condition what was avoided even by a once healthier self in the past. And cynicism about the future rationalizes the avoidance and deception. That is hell, and there is no limit to its depth. The humility required to clamber out of such hell exists in precise proportion to the magnitude of the unrequited errors of the past. And that is enough to send a shudder of true terror down the spine of anyone even partly awakened. We are not allowed, it seems, to avoid the responsibility of actualizing potential. And if we have made a mistake in the past and left what could be unmanifest, regardless of the reason, then we pay the price for that in the inability to forget and in the emotion that constitutes the pangs of conscience for past misbehavior. Imagine that when you are very young, the map of the world you use to guide your immature self is correspondingly underdeveloped. Like a child's drawing of a house, always straight and centered, portraying only the front, always or close enough with a door and two windows, always with a square for the outside wall and a triangle for the roof. Always with a chimney and smoke, which is a surprise because smoking chimneys are not all that common now. The sun is shining irrepressibly, a circle with rays emanating from it. There are a few flowers, single lines with the schematic of a bloom at the top, and two leaves halfway up the stems. It is a very low-resolution representation of a house. It is more hieroglyph than drawing, more concept than sketch. It is something that represents the idea of house, or perhaps home, generically, like the words house or home themselves. However, it is almost always enough. The child who drew the picture knows it's a house, and the other children and the adults who see the picture know it is a house. The drawing does the trick. It fulfills its purpose. It is a good enough map. But all too often, appalling events occur within houses. These are not so easy to represent. Maybe the house has adults in it, parents, grandparents, uncles, or aunts, who say such things as, never, and I mean never, speak to anyone about what happens here. A few squares, a triangle, a smattering of flowers, and a benevolent solar orb offer only an inadequate representation of the horrors characterizing such a dwelling place. Maybe what is happening inside the house is beyond both tolerability and understanding. But how can what is terrifying be beyond understanding? How can trauma even exist without comprehension? Is not understanding in some sense a prerequisite to experience itself? These are all great mysteries. But everything is not experienced at the same level of conception. We have all been petrified by the unknown, even though that seems a contradiction in terms. But the body knows what the mind does not yet grasp, and it remembers, and it demands that understanding be established, and there is simply no escaping that demand. If something befalls us, or perhaps worse, we engage in some act that freezes us in terror and nauseates us to recall, we are bound by implacable fate to transform raw horror into understanding or suffer the consequences. Do not fall twice into the same pit. I had a client who began speaking to me almost immediately after we met of the sexual abuse she suffered in childhood at the hands of an older cousin with whom she lived. She became markedly tearful and upset when she recounted her experiences. I asked her how old she was when the abuse occurred. She told me she was 4. She described her attacker as much larger, stronger, and older than her. I allowed my imagination to roam freely as she spoke, making the assumptions I believed, or my fantasy presumed, were justified by the nature of her description. I envisioned the nefarious, sadistic, and criminal machinations of a late adolescent or young adult. Then I asked her how much difference in age there was between her and her victimizer. She replied, 2 years. He was 2 years older than me. This came as a genuine surprise. It changed the picture in my mind almost completely. I told her what I had been imagining because I wanted her to know what assumptions I had been formulating as she related her story. Then I said, "You know, you're all grown up now and have been for a long time. But you told me your story in the same way that you might have told it when you were 4 when the molestation was still occurring, or at least with many of the same emotions. And there is no doubt that you remember your cousin as much larger and stronger and older than you. A 6-year-old is, after all, half again as old as a 4-year-old, and from that younger child's perspective, perhaps more akin to an adult. But your cousin was 6, almost as much a child as you. So here's another way you might consider thinking about what happened. First, recall the 6-year-olds with whom you are now familiar. You know that they are still immature and cannot be held accountable as adults might be for their actions, even though they might also not be altogether innocent. I am not trying to minimize the seriousness of what happened to you, and I am not questioning the intensity of your emotions. But I am asking you to consider the situation as if you became aware of its occurrence among 2 children you presently know. Kids are curious. They play doctor. And if the adults around them are not paying attention properly, such games can get out of hand. Would it be possible to consider that you were not molested by an overpowering and malevolent force the way you might be if you were raped now? Maybe, instead, you and your cousin were very poorly supervised children. In some important way, the memories she retained of her childhood experiences had not altered as she matured. She was still experiencing the terror of a 4-year-old, helpless in the hands of someone old enough to be perceived as grown-up. But her 27-year-old self needed to update that memory. She was no longer at risk for such treatment in any obvious manner. And it came as a great relief to her to reframe what had happened. She could now consider it as a potential consequence of curiosity untrammeled by adult attention. This shifted her view of her cousin, the situation, and herself. She could now see the event from the perspective of an adult. This freed her from much of the terror and shame still associated with the memories, and it did so with remarkable rapidity. She confronted the horrors of the past voluntarily, finding a causal explanation that was much less traumatic, lacking as it did the vision of her cousin as a malevolent, powerful perpetrator and her as the inevitably hapless victim of such a force. All this transformation occurred in a single session. Such can be the power of the story surrounding the terrible events of our pasts. This experience left me with a profound philosophical quandary. The memories my client brought into my office had remained unchanged for decades. The memories she walked out with were markedly altered. Which, then, were real? It could easily be argued that her original story was more accurate. It was, after all, as direct an imprint as might be left on the open book of a 4-year-old's mind. It had not been altered, and therefore changed, by any previous therapeutic intervention. Was it not, then, the genuine article? But it is also the case that an event that means one thing one day might come to mean something quite different another. Is it so unusual for us to better understand what motivated the otherwise inexplicable behavior of our parents, for example, as we ourselves enter parenthood? And which memory is more accurate, the partial picture of adult motivation we have as children, or the revised recollections made possible by maturity? If it is the latter, and that does not seem unreasonable, it certainly seemed true in the case of my client, how is it that an altered memory can become more accurate than one retaining its original configuration? Possessed by ghosts. I recall another client who remembered, in a striking sense, and changed. His memories were shrouded much more profoundly in mystery, and his remembrance was of a slower, more surprising, and unlikelier sort. He was a young, gay, African-American man who was suffering from a set of incomprehensible mental and physical symptoms. A psychiatrist had recently diagnosed him with schizophrenia, but his aunt, who had taken him to the hospital for evaluation, believed that insufficient time had been spent on her nephew's evaluation. She contacted me for a second opinion and brought him to my office. I saw him alone. He was shy and reserved, but neatly and carefully dressed, and appeared fully oriented when I started to gather his history. Furthermore, he wore eyeglasses, and they were well taken care of, lacking tape on the bridger arms and with lenses that were perfectly clean. These observations were all relevant as far as I was concerned. Schizophrenics lose the ability to monitor themselves effectively, so unkempt clothing and damaged eyeglasses, particularly with badly smudged lenses, are telling features. Not invariably, so those of you with subpar eyewear are not required to consider yourself classified. In any case, he also had a full-time job of reasonable complexity, another rarity for someone with schizophrenia, and he could carry on a conversation with no problem, apart from his tendency towards shyness. I accepted him as a client, and we began to meet regularly. I had to see him a few times before I could determine why the psychiatrist had diagnosed him with such a serious disorder. He began by telling me that for the last 4 years he had been depressed and anxious. There was nothing markedly uncommon in that. His symptoms followed on the heels of a serious fight with his boyfriend and the permanent cessation of their relationship, which had lasted several years. Nothing in that was unusual either. The two had been living together. Their partnership was important to him, emotionally and practically, and the dissolution of an intimate relationship produces unhappiness and confusion in most everyone, and can trigger more severe and lasting anxiety and depression in people who are so predisposed. The duration was out of the ordinary, however. People typically pick up the pieces and move on in under a year. That is not a hard and fast rule, but 4 years is a long time. That piqued my curiosity. He also revealed something else very much out of the ordinary. He told me that he experienced strange, convulsive bodily movements every night while attempting to sleep. His body would contort into a fetal position and his arms would cross over his face. Then he would relax, only to find himself repeating the movements. So it went. Apart from being concerning because of its incomprehensibility, it was interfering badly with his sleep. This had been going on for about the same amount of time as the anxiety and depression, and the poor sleep, if not the movements themselves, was certainly a contributing factor. I asked him what he thought was happening. He said, with a laugh, "My family thinks I'm possessed, and I'm not sure they are wrong." My client's familial background was somewhat unusual. His parents, immigrants to Canada from the southern United States, were uneducated to a marked degree, very superstitious and religious, and apparently serious in the belief that spirits inhabited their son. I asked him, "Did you by chance tell the psychiatrist about being possessed?" He said, "Yes." I thought, well, that explains why he diagnosed you with schizophrenia. That explanation, in tandem with the strange physical symptoms, would have been sufficient, in my experience. However, after meeting with this man for several sessions, it was clear to me that whatever was plaguing him was not schizophrenia. He was perfectly rational and lucid. But what in the world could be causing these strange, nightly, seizure-like convulsions? I had never encountered anything of the sort. My first hypothesis was that he suffered from a very severe form of sleep paralysis. This is a reasonably common condition. It generally occurs when people are sleeping on their backs, which he tended to do. A person with sleep paralysis semi-awakens, but not enough to stop dreaming, nor to escape from the inability to move that characterizes the rapid eye movement, REM, phase of sleeping. When you are dreaming, the same brain areas that govern active movement when you are awake are often stimulated. You experience this as the sense of moving while in your dream. You do not move around in sync with that brain activation because your voluntary musculature is switched off physiologically by a specialized neurochemical mechanism that has exactly that function. Otherwise, you would get out of bed and act out your dream and get yourself in trouble very quickly. During a sleep paralysis episode, the sufferer wakes up enough to be semi-aware of the real world, but is still in REM paralysis and dreaming. All sorts of strange experiences can occur in such a state. Many people have, for example, claimed to have been abducted and medically examined by aliens. This otherwise inexplicable nighttime phenomenon, barring the existence of curious and surgically inclined extraterrestrials, has been blamed on this condition of immobility and the often bizarre and frightening fantasies that accompany it. He was quite bright, literate, and curious, so I gave him a book called The Terror That Comes in the Night, which illuminates the strange phenomena that can accompany sleep paralysis. The author, David Hufford, describes the night terror his title refers to as a variant of the old hag experience, a term from folklore. Those who have had such an experience, up to 15% of the population, describe fear and paralysis, sensations of suffocation, and encounters with malign entities. My client read the book, but told me that he did not believe what Hufford described accurately characterized his experience. He felt the same way about the sleep paralysis hypothesis, more generally. For one thing, the convulsions occurred before he fell asleep. Second, he did not experience the inability to move. I learned much more about him as we continued to get to know one another. I learned, for example, that he had studied history as an undergraduate and had completed his degree. I learned that his parents had been exceptionally strict with him through his childhood and teenage years. They never allowed him to stay overnight at his friends' houses, and they monitored his behavior very closely until he escaped to university. He also related a fair bit more about the fight that occurred immediately before the breakup of his last relationship. He had returned with his boyfriend to their shared apartment after having a few drinks and arguing in public. At home, the fight escalated to physical conflict. They began pushing each other around with increasing violence. After one particularly aggressive shove, my client fell to the living room floor. While lying there, he swept his boyfriend's feet out from underneath him. Then my client picked himself up and headed for the door. He returned several days later when he knew his boyfriend would not be at home to pack up his belongings and move. That was the end of their existence as a couple. But there was an element of his personality at play in this conflict that was not obvious. In consequence, he was struck very deeply by his boyfriend's assault. He told me while discussing this sequence of events that he did not believe people were capable of violence. I said, "What do you mean by that? You earned a history degree. You have obviously read about the horrors and atrocities of the human past. You watch the news." He said that, as a matter of fact, he did not watch the news. Fair enough, I replied, but what about everything you learned in university? Did not that teach you that human aggression is both real and exceptionally common? He said, I read the books, but I just put everything I had learned into a compartment and did not think any further about it. I thought that was a striking answer, particularly in combination with something else he told me. When I was a child, he said, I picked up the idea that people were only good. My parents taught me that adults were angels. I asked, what do you mean by that? That adults never did anything bad or wrong? He said, no. You do not understand. My parents taught me and my sister and brother that adults were literally God's angels, and that they were only good. I said, you believe this? He said that he had believed it deeply, partly because he had been so sheltered, partly because his parents had been so insistent, and partly, of course, because it was comforting. I suggested that something had to be done about his naivete. It was not doing him any good. He was far too old and intelligent to maintain faith in such a childish dream. We discussed this in detail, speaking about the horrific events of the 20th century and the mass shootings and other terrors of the more recent past. I asked him to explain such occurrences and to pay more attention to any examples of his own anger and hostility. However, he denied the very existence of the latter and could not generate any convincing explanations for the former. So, I assigned him a book called Ordinary Men. That book excruciatingly details how a group of ordinary policemen from Germany were turned into cold-blooded executioners in Poland during the Nazi occupation. To call the account chilling is to say almost nothing. I told him with all due seriousness that he had to read the book as if it really happened, and more, as if he and the people he knew were capable of the same heinous acts. It was time for him to grow up. We'd established a very solid rapport by this time, and when I told him that his rose-colored view of the world was presenting him with danger sufficient to destroy his life, he took me seriously. The next time I saw him, a week later, he had finished the book. His face had hardened. He looked older and wiser. I had seen this happen frequently in my clinical practice. When people incorporated the darker parts of themselves, instead of, let us say, compartmentalizing them, they no longer had the habitual look of deer caught in the headlights. They looked like people from whom decisions emanated, rather than people to whom things merely happened. Then I asked him to read The Rape of Nanking, about Japanese atrocities in China in 1937. It is a horrifying book. The woman who wrote it committed suicide. My client read that too, and we talked about it. He emerged sadder, but wiser. His nighttime symptoms, however, did not abate. Nonetheless, his comments about adults as angels, claims to have compartmentalized his knowledge of evil, and the presence of the inexplicable convulsions had started some wheels turning in the far recesses of my brain. Many years earlier, I had another client, a young woman, as is more typically the case, who had hysterical epilepsy, a classic case of Freudian hysteria, where bodily symptoms were expressing psychological problems. She had been raised in the rural Midwest in a very repressed, Victorian-like Christian fundamentalist atmosphere. She had one of her seizures in my office, full grand mal. The sight of it left me cold. I watched impassively as she thrashed and convulsed violently for several minutes, eyes rolled back. I did not worry. I did not feel sorry for her. I did not feel anything. I thought, why is this not affecting me? My client is having, by all evidence, a serious convulsive episode. I did not call an ambulance. When she came out of it and sat back down, dazed, I told her that I had responded to her seizure neither physically nor emotionally, as if it were real, despite its otherwise fully credible manifestation. Previously, after pulling similar stunts, consciously, unconsciously, some mixture of the two, she had barely skirted consignment to a psychiatric ward. She had also risked a diagnosis of psychosis and prescription for the medication accompanying that. We had some very serious talks about what she was doing. I let her know that I did not buy her epilepsy, that I had experienced it as false, even though it seemed quite real to her. She had been tested, by the way, for epilepsy, and the results had come back equivocal. So, she was plausibly someone who somatized or physically represented their psychological symptoms. Freud noted that such somatization was often symbolic, that the manner in which the physical disability or oddity manifested had some meaningful relationship with the trauma that had precipitated it. Her hysterical epilepsy appeared to originate in her ambivalence and ignorance about sex, a substantial degree of childish immaturity, and some dangerous game-playing on her part. We made a lot of progress in our discussions. She was far from unintelligent, and the wiser part of her prevailed. Her seizures came to an end, along with the equally dangerous drama. Even better, she avoided the psych ward and continued with her university career. In any case, I learned then that Freudian hysterics existed, because I had just worked with one. I began to hypothesize that my current client was suffering in a similar manner from a somatization disorder. I knew about the fight that had terminated his last relationship just before the onset of his symptoms. Perhaps his strange movements were somehow associated with that event. I also knew from his own account that he compartmentalized, that he put things in a corner of his mind where he would not think about them again. I did not have much experience with hypnosis, but knew both that people capable of compartmentalization tended to be highly hypnotizable, and that hypnosis had been used with some success, albeit many years ago, with somatization disorders. Freud used hypnosis to treat his hysterical clients, who were apparently quite numerous during the Victorian period, at least in the upper class, fixated as they were on the sexual, the theatrical, and the dramatic. So, I thought I might try hypnosis to treat my client. Now, I often used guided relaxation techniques on my clients, sitting them comfortably in their armchair in my office, asking them to focus on different parts of their body, from the soles of their feet, step by step, up their legs and torso, with a brief detour down their arms, to the top of their head, focusing on their breathing and relaxing. After 7 or 8 minutes of the relaxation instructions, I would count back from 10 to 1, requesting after each count or two that they relax more deeply. It was a reasonably good, quick treatment for agitation, anxiety, and insomnia. Clinical hypnosis employs essentially the same technique, adding questions about past trauma or other relevant issues once relaxation had been established. Its effectiveness varies substantially from person to person. That is why stage performers who use hypnosis on audience members will bring 20 people to the front of the theater, run through the initial hypnotic suggestions, and then retain only the few who are obviously responsive. In any case, I told my client that I thought hypnotizing him and talking about the night he fought with his boyfriend might be useful. I told him why, suggesting that his nighttime movements might be associated with that event. Then I told him exactly how we were going to do it and that he was free to refuse or agree. I would stop whenever he asked me to, if he asked, and he would remember everything when we were finished. He agreed to try, so I began. Sit comfortably in your chair. Place your hands on the arms of the chair or in your lap, wherever you are most comfortable. Close your eyes. Listen carefully to the noises that you hear in the world around you, and then turn your attention inward to your breathing. Breathe in deeply. Hold it. Breathe out. Move your attention down your body from your breathing to your thighs and lower legs and feet. Let your feet rest heavily on the floor. Pay attention to your toes and the soles of your feet and your ankles. And remember to breathe slowly, regularly, and deeply. Let all the tension flow out of your feet. Do not forget to breathe slowly, regularly, and deeply. Pay attention to your calves and your shins, and so on, up the whole body. Usually, my client fell spontaneously into a deep hypnotic trance before I got past his feet. His head lolled heavily. I asked if he could hear me. Yes, he said, barely audibly. I had to advance my chair and put my ear within inches of his mouth to make out what he was saying. I asked him if he knew where he was. "In your office," he said. That was good. I said, "We are returning to the time when you had a fight with your boyfriend, before you moved out. Tell me what happened." He said, "We had just returned to our house. We had both been drinking. We were fighting about finances and our future at the bar. We both got angry. We walked through the doorway of our house. There." He half-gestured with his arm, although it was still mostly limp, like the rest of his body. I was watching his eyes dart back and forth, like those of someone in REM sleep, under three-quarter closed lids. I was walking backward. We were moving toward the living room. I pushed him. Then he pushed me back. I pushed him again. He pushed me backward over our coffee table and onto the floor. He picked up our floor lamp and held it over his head. I looked directly into his eyes. I had never seen an expression so hostile. I curled into a ball and crossed my hands over my face to protect myself. He said this all very slowly, gesturing awkwardly and minimally all the time, pointing as if toward the area in the room he was imagining. It was uncannily as if he were reliving the experience in real time. I glanced at the clock. The explanation, preparation, relaxation, and the slow recounting had taken us up to the one-hour mark, our normal session duration. I said, "I did not want to push you too far. We're running out of time. When you are ready and comfortable, you might open your eyes and wake up fully. We could continue next week." But he did not respond. His head continued to loll forward and his eyes kept moving. I called his name. No change. This worried me, quite frankly. I had never heard of someone failing to emerge from a trance when requested. I was not sure what to do. Fortunately, however, he was the last client I was seeing that evening, so I had some time. I thought, well, he is in a deep trance and truly immersed in this account. Maybe he needs to tell the whole story. Let us continue and see what happens. When he is finished with his account, I will try to bring him around again. I went out to the hallway to speak with his waiting aunt and informed her that we required a bit more time. I returned to my office and sat back down near him as before. I said, "What happened then?" He replied, "The expression on his face, I had never seen someone look like that before. I was forced to realize then that my boyfriend could want to hurt me. That one person, even if adult, could truly desire to bring harm to another. It was the first time I truly learned that such events were possible." He began to weep, but continued his account. I knocked his feet out from under him, got up, and started running. He chased me out of the living room, down the hallway of our house, and through the front door. I could run faster and got ahead of him. It was about 4 in the morning. It was still dark. I was terrified. I got far enough ahead of him to hide behind some nearby cars. He could not find me. I watched him looking for a long while. Then he gave up and turned around. He was sobbing openly by this point. When I was sure he was gone, I went to my mother's place and stayed there. I could not believe what had happened. He might have killed me, and he was going to do it on purpose. I couldn't stand it. I pushed it from my mind and tried never to think about it again. He fell silent. I called his name. He responded. I asked him, "Do you know that you are in my office and sitting in the chair you usually occupy?" He nodded. "Are you finished telling me your story?" He replied in the affirmative. I said, "You did well. It was very brave of you to go through all that. Are you ready to open your eyes?" He said that he was. I said, "Take your time. When you are ready, come back fully awake, slowly. You're going to feel relaxed and well. You will remember everything you just told me and everything that happened here." He nodded. A few moments later, he opened his eyes. I asked him what had happened, what he remembered. He briefly recounted the evening's events, including our initial discussion about hypnosis. I then called in his aunt and told her that he needed to rest at home with someone in attendance because the session had been intense. Adults were not angels. And people could not only hurt each other, they could desire that hurt with all their heart. But my client did not know what to do with such knowledge. Sheltered as he was, deluded as he was by his parents, blind as he allowed himself to remain with his compartmentalization. This did not stop the inarticulate elements of his being from endeavoring to dramatically represent and bring toward consciousness both the fact of intended harm and everything more broadly evil such intent implied. He found himself compelled to duplicate precisely the defensive bodily movements he had made during the fight with his boyfriend. The next week, my client did not show up for his session. I thought, oh God, maybe I did him some serious damage. However, he arrived on time the next week. He apologized for missing the last session, but said that he had become extremely upset and was in consequence too scrambled to attend or even to contact me. I asked why. He said, the day after we last met, I was sitting in a restaurant downtown and I saw my old boyfriend. It was an uncanny coincidence. It really rattled me, you know, he continued, but nothing came of it, and I calmed down in a day or two. And guess what? What, I said. I only had convulsions one night this week, and they only lasted a few minutes. I said, that is great. That is really great. What a relief. What do you think changed? He said, what really got to me in that fight was not our disagreement about what future we wanted. It was not the physical contact, the pushing and shoving. It was the fact that he truly wished me harm. I could see it in his face. His look truly terrified me. I could not handle it. But I can understand it better now. I asked him if I could hypnotize him again. You are obviously better, I said, but I want to make sure that we got everything. He agreed, and we began. He fell into a trance just as easily, but this time he condensed the story. He got through the whole account in 15 minutes as opposed to the 90 required previously. He had extracted what was important, the fact that he was in danger, the fact that someone wanted to hurt him, the fact that he had defended himself successfully, the fact that the world was a place inhabited by demons, so to speak, as well as angels. When I asked him to come out of the trance, in the same way I had before, he opened his eyes almost immediately and was calm and fully aware. The change in his condition was remarkable. The next week, he said that his symptoms had disappeared completely. No more convulsions, and no more belief in the untarnished goodness of mankind. He had grown up and faced the reality of his own experience as well as the nature of the world. It was something to see. Conscious acceptance of the presence of malevolence cured him of years of suffering. He now understood and admitted enough of the potential dangers that surrounded him to make his way in reasonable safety through the world. It was no longer necessary for what he had learned but refused to acknowledge to force itself upon him in its dramatic, embodied manner. He made what he now knew part of his personality, part of the map that would guide him henceforth in his actions, and freed himself from the ghosts that possessed him. Uncomprehended malevolence. I had another client, a young man who was terribly bullied in his first year of vocational college. When he first came to see me, he could barely talk and was taking a high dose of antipsychotic medication. When he sat in the chair in front of the desk in my office, he would twist his head and shoulders back and forth in a very abnormal and mechanical manner. When I asked him what he was doing, he told me that he was trying to make the shapes go away. Apparently, he could perceive geometric images of some kind in front of him and felt compelled to manipulate them. I never did understand exactly what that signified, except that he was in a world of his own. I spent several months working with him and did it in a more structured manner than I had previously, having in the interim developed the tools to do so. This client could only communicate a little at the beginning of our work together, but that was enough to start the ball rolling. Some girl at the college had developed a crush on him. He informed her that her romantic interest was not reciprocated. She became exceedingly vindictive and set out to make his life hell. She spread rumors about his sexual habits. She encouraged some of her male friends to physically threaten him at school. She had people on hand to humiliate him constantly and unmercifully in transit to and from campus. Noting his distress, His parents alerted the school, but nothing was done to stop the ongoing torment. Unable or unwilling to tolerate the mounting peer pressure, the friends he had only recently made began to avoid and then entirely abandoned him. He began to break down, and as his behavior became stranger, his outcast status was cemented into place, and he broke. I asked him to let me know exactly what happened, and to reach a long way back while formulating his answer. I wanted to understand what, if anything, made him vulnerable to the situation he found himself in, and what exactly had happened when he was being tormented by his spurned admirer. And I structured this so that he could write as well as talk, more accurately, so that he could talk about what he was writing. My colleagues and I had developed an online writing exercise to provide some helpful structure for those delving into and making sense of their past. I asked my young client to try it. Because he was too impaired in his motivation and his thoughts to complete the process at home, I had him do his writing in my office. I set him at my computer and asked him to read each question in the exercise aloud to me before writing his answer, and then to read that aloud as well. If I failed to understand something he had written or felt that more detail was required, I suggested he clarify the issues at hand with more writing and read me his revisions. The exercise opened by asking him to break his life into key epochs, sections of his autobiographical past that lent themselves naturally to categorization as a unit or theme. That might be, say, age 2 through kindergarten, elementary school, junior high, high school, college, etc., although some people are inclined, particularly as they get older, to group their experiences according to the various relationships of which they were a member. After he subdivided his past in the manner he chose, the exercise then asked him to identify key experiences during each of these epochs, events that he believed, in retrospect, shaped him as a person, for better or worse. Obviously, events of the latter type are likely to be marked in memory by negative emotions, such as anxiety, anger, or the desire for revenge, and perhaps by a strong tendency to avoid remembering and considering altogether. My client broke his life into the epochs that seemed relevant to him, and then identified the key events, both positive and negative, characterizing each period. Next, he analyzed them causally, coming to understand why some things had gone well while others had deteriorated so terribly. He concentrated most intensely on what gave rise to the most disturbing events of the past, assessing particulars of his own behavior, motivations of other people, and characteristics of time and place. He considered what effects those produced, for better or worse, because we can all learn things from difficult experiences, and thought through what might have happened or been done differently. The consequence of all this, at least in principle, was the mining of past experiences for their true perceptual and behavioral significance, and an update of his autobiographical map. As his account progressed from daycare through public schooling, he had divided his life into sections defined by school grade, he became increasingly articulate. Recollecting his life was putting him back together. As he wrote, read what he wrote, and answered the questions I put to him while listening, his account of the past became more detailed and his understanding of it deeper. We discussed the undesirable things that children do to each other, and that led us to the topic of malevolence and evil in the adult world as well. He was very naive about this. He expressed the belief that people were universally good, even though he had experience to the contrary. He had no theory of motivation for destruction, cruelty, and the desire for mayhem. We walked through his life, developing a particularly detailed account of everything he had suffered at the hands of his tormentor. He became sophisticated enough to articulate some initial understanding of her motivations. She had been spurned and was, in consequence, hurt, embarrassed, and angry. He had not realized either how much impact his rejection might produce or how much impact rejection can have on people in general. He did not seem to understand, furthermore, that he had the right to defend himself. We talked about what he could have done differently or might do differently in the future to protect himself. He realized that he had taken far too much insult at school without reaching out for help. He could have let the appropriate administrative staff at the college know what was going on. He could have confronted his tormentor directly, publicly, earlier in the abuse, and demanded that she stop. He could have let his classmates know that the only reason he was being tormented was because he had refused a date, and that she was so fragile and brittle that she could not handle the rejection and was inventing lies for revenge. In the extreme, he could have had her charged with criminal harassment and defamatory libel. None of these strategies would have been sure to work, but they would have been worth trying and were certainly justified and necessary under the circumstances. As he worked through the memories of his recent months at college, his psychotic symptoms receded dramatically. At every session he attended, he was more clear-headed. He stopped manifesting his strange behaviors. He enrolled in summer school and finished his remaining coursework. It was a near miraculous recovery. Potential into actuality. It is far from uncommon for people to worry, sometimes unbearably, about what lies ahead of them. That worry is both a consequence of and an investigation into the multiple pathways extending from now into the future. Concerns line themselves up, often involuntarily, for consideration. Troublesome issues at work, problems with friends and loved ones, practical issues of economic and material survival. Each concern requires multiple decisions. What problems should be solved? In what order should action proceed? What strategy should be employed? All of this requires something like choice, free choice, free will. And the choice to act seems voluntary and difficult. It is therefore a simple thing, although very psychologically unsatisfying, to succumb to paralysis of will. To decide feels nothing like the automatic processes of reflexive or habitual pathways moving us thoughtlessly forward. We do not appear to ourselves to be driven by the past in some fundamentally deterministic manner, like a mechanical clock in which the springs drive the gears that turn the hands and tell the time. Instead, when we decide, we actively confront the future. We seem destined to face something akin to unformed potential and to determine what will emerge as the present and then the past. We literally make the world what it is from the many things we perceive it could be. Doing so is perhaps the primary fact of our being and perhaps of being itself. We face a multitude of prospects, of manifold realities, each almost tangible, and by choosing one pathway rather than another, reduce that multitude to the singular actuality of reality. In doing so, we bring the world from becoming into being. This is the most profound of mysteries. What is that potential that confronts us? And what constitutes our strange ability to shape that possibility and to make what is real and concrete from what begins in some sense as the merely imaginary? There is something else of perhaps equal import allied with this, impossible as that might seem, given the very unlikeliness of the role we appear to play in the shaping of reality. Not only do our choices play a determining role in transforming the multiplicity of the future into the actuality of the present, but, more specifically, the ethics of our choices play that role. Actions based on the desire to take responsibility, to make things better, to avoid temptation and face what we would rather avoid, to act voluntarily, courageously, and truthfully, these make what comes into being much better in all ways for ourselves and for others than what arises as a consequence of avoidance, resentment, the search for revenge, or the desire for mayhem. This means that if we act ethically, in the deepest and most universal of senses, then the tangible reality that emerges from the potential we face will be good instead of dreadful, or at least as good as we can make it. Everyone seems to know this. We are universally tormented by our consciences for what we know we should have done, yet did not do. We are tormented equally by what we did, but know we should not have done. Is this not a universal experience? Can anyone escape the pangs of conscience at 4 o'clock in the morning after acting immorally or destructively, or failing to act when action was necessary? And what is the source for that inescapable conscience? If we were the source of our own values and masters of our own houses, then we could act or fail to act as we choose and not suffer the pangs of regret, sorrow, and shame. But I have never met anyone who could manage that. Even the most psychopathic of people seem motivated at least to mask their malfeasance with a layer of lies, with the depth of that layer precisely proportionate to the severity of the impropriety in question. Even the most malevolent, it appears, must find justification for his or her evil. If we fail to hold ourselves to that standard of responsibility, then other people regard us as lacking in ethics and integrity, and it does not end there. Just as we hold people, including ourselves, accountable for the wrongs they have done or the good they have failed to do, we also believe, or at least act out the proposition, that someone who has made a good decision freely deserves whatever benefit might come of it. It is for that reason that we believe each person should justly receive the fruit of their honest and voluntary labor. There seems something natural and inevitable about such judgments, something at work within us that is universal and inescapable, psychologically and socially. What all this means is that everyone, child, adult, self, others, will rebel against being treated as a cog in a wheel, incapable of choice and devoid of freedom, and similarly, that it is practically impossible to establish a positive relationship with any other, or even our private selves, without that attribution of personal agency, free will, and responsibility. The Word as Savior. The twin ideas that we all are, as sovereign individuals, first, voluntarily participating in the act of creation itself, and second, determining the quality of that creation with the ethics of our choices, finds reflection in myriad manners within our relationships, private and public. These ideas are also encapsulated and represented in the narratives, the fundamental narratives that sit at the base of our culture. These stories, whatever their ultimate metaphysical significance, are at least in part a consequence of our watching ourselves act across eons of human history and distilling from that watching the essential patterns of our actions. We are cartographers, makers of maps, geographers, concerned with the layout of the land. But we are also, more precisely and accurately, charters of courses, sailors and explorers. We recall the places we started from, the positions we occupied when our stories began. We remember the pitfalls and successes of the past so that we can avoid the former and repeat the latter. To do so, we need to know where we have been, where we currently are, and in what direction we are headed. We reduce that account to its causal structure. We need to know what happened and why, and we need to know it as simply and practically as possible. It is for such reasons we are so captivated by people who can tell a story, who can share their experiences concisely and precisely, and who get to the point. That point, the moral of the story, is what they learned about who and where they were or are, and where they are going and why. Such information is irresistible to us all. It is how and why we derive wisdom from the risks taken by those before us and who live to tell the story. This is what life was like then. This is what we wanted and why. This is what we envisioned and how we strategized, planned, and then acted. Sometimes we succeeded and realized our aims. But too often, and this is what is crucial to a great story, here is how what we did not expect occurred. Here is how we were knocked off the path. Here are the tragedies we encountered and the mistakes we made. And here is how we put the world back together or failed to do so. We value such stories particularly if they have attained the pinnacle of generalizability, representing heroic battles with the unknown as such, or the dissolution of tyrannical order into revivifying chaos and the reestablishment of benevolent society. This can be seen everywhere that people tell and listen avidly to stories, and that is literally everywhere. The most fundamental stories of the West are to be found, for better or worse, in the biblical corpus. That collection of ancient and eminently influential books opens with God himself in his fatherly guise, portrayed as the ordered entity who confronts chaos and creates habitable order in consequence. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Genesis 1:2. This formlessness, void, darkness, and water, a confusing conglomeration of attributes, is a consequence of the translation of a biblical Hebrew phrase, toyu wa boyu, made up of two words, toyu and boyu. Toyu is even more complicated than mere formlessness, etc. It also means that which is laid waste, vanity, which might be something likely to be laid to waste, psychologically speaking, and desert, which is uninhabitable and void. It is also associated with another Hebrew word, Teom, which is the source of the phrase the deep. Teom, in turn, means the abyss, and is associated with an earlier Sumerian term, Tiamat, who is the great mother goddess, dragon, and denizen of salt water, who creates the world with her consort Apsu in the Mesopotamian creation myth, Enuma Elish. According to the Genesis account, there exists something, a potential, let us say, associated symbolically with the abyss, with the oceanic depths, but also with desert, dragons, maternality / matriarchy, emptiness, formlessness, and darkness. This is all the attempt of poetry and metaphor to give initial, ordered, conceptual form to the formless. The abyss is what terrifies, what is at the end of the earth, what we gaze upon when contemplating our mortality and fragility, and what devours hope. Water is depth and the source of life itself. The desert is a place of abandonment, isolation, and loneliness, as well as the interregnum between tyranny and the promised land. The dragon is the ancient image of the predator as such, the fire-breathing tree, cat, snake, bird, eternally lurking in the forest beyond the familiar confines of tribe and village. It is as well the Leviathan hidden in the salt water, the depths. The terrible monster Jehovah refers to overcoming in Job 41, 25-34 and in many other places in the Old Testament accounts. God has an attribute, or an alternative person, or a faculty, or a tool that aids him or that he relies on when confronting possibility and the void. That is the word from the Christian perspective, but certainly the capacity for speech, regardless of religious framework, Jewish or Christian. There is a continual insistence in Genesis on the importance of speech. The act of creation on each day begins with the phrase, "And God said," with additional emphasis on the act of naming, "And God called." The 7 days of creation begin. "And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day." Genesis 1, 3-5. Almost immediately after God first reveals himself, his creative actions, and the initial creation, thus, almost instantly after we are introduced to him, he creates human beings. Three features of that creation stand forth in addition to its immediacy. The insistence that mankind is to have dominion over the rest of creation. The shocking and incomprehensibly modern and egalitarian insistence that God created man and woman equally in his own image, stated twice, Genesis 1:27. And the equally unlikely and miraculous insistence that the creation of humanity was, like the rest of the creation, good. If God is, above all, as he is initially described, that implies that the men and women created in his image share with him something of import, or, more to the point, they share an analogous destiny, necessity, or responsibility. The word, the tool God uses to transform the depths of potential, is truthful speech. It appears necessarily allied, however, with the courage to confront unrealized possibility in all its awful potential so that reality itself may be brought forth. Perhaps both this truth and courage must finally be subsumed in turn under the broader principle of love. Love for being itself despite its fragility, tyranny, and betrayal. Love that has as its aim what is best for the best in everything. It is that combination of truth, courage, and love comprising the ideal, whose active incarnation in each individual does, in fact, take the potential of the future and make the best of it. And who would deny this? No one teaches a beloved son to cringe in terror and cowardice from what confronts him. No one teaches a beloved daughter that deceit will set the world right and that whatever works expediently is to be practiced, honored, and mimicked. And no one tells anyone he or she cares for that the proper response to being is hatred and the desire to produce pain, suffering, mayhem, and catastrophe. Thus, it can be assumed from analysis of our own behavior that we know the difference between the pathway of good and the pathway of evil, and that we believe above all, despite our conscious resistance and prideful argument, in the existence of both. But there is yet more. The insistence of God on the goodness of creation reflected the fact that truth, courage, and love were united in his creative action. Thus, there is an ethical claim deeply embedded in the Genesis account of creation. Everything that emerges from the realm of possibility in the act of creation, arguably either divine or human, is good insofar as the motive for its creation is good. I do not believe there is a more daring argument in all of philosophy or in theology than this. To believe this, to act it out, is the fundamental act of faith. There is an argument presented much later in the biblical narrative in the New Testament. Christ says the following words to his followers. It is a commentary on the potential for completing your life, for reclaiming what you have lost, or even discovering what you did not know was there. And I say unto you, ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. If a son shall ask bread of any of you that is a father, will he give him a stone? Or if he ask a fish, will he for a fish give him a serpent? Or if he shall ask an egg, will he offer him a scorpion? If ye then, being evil, know how to give good gifts unto your children, how much more shall your heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to them that ask him? Luke 11:9-13. This is not a casual statement. It is not naive. It is not a matter of asking for a present unearned. God is no granter of casual wishes. It is a matter, first, of truly asking. This means being willing to let go of anything and everything that is not in keeping with the desire. Otherwise, there is no asking. There is only an immature and too often resentful whim and wish. Oh, that I could have what I want without doing what is necessary. That will not suffice. So, to ask, seek, and knock is to do everything required to gather what has been left unfinished and to complete it now. And to ask, seek, and knock is, as well, to determine what must be asked for. And that has to be something that is worthy of God. Why else would it be granted? How else could it possibly be granted? Imagine for a moment you have been given all you need. There is possibility within you, waiting for the proper demand to release itself. There is all that is outside of you, waiting to inform and teach you. But all of it is necessary, the good, bad, and unbearable. You know that when something does not go well, you should analyze the problem, resolve it, apologize, repent, and transform. An unsolved problem seldom sits there in stasis. It grows new heads like a hydra. One lie, one act of avoidance breeds the necessity for more. One act of self-deception generates the requirement to buttress that self-deceptive belief with new delusions. One devastated relationship, unaddressed, damages your reputation, damages your faith in yourself equally, and decreases the probability of a new and better relationship. Thus, Your refusal or even inability to come to terms with the errors of the past expands the source of such error, expands the unknown that surrounds you, transforms that unknown into something increasingly predatory. And while that is happening, you get weaker. You are less than you could be because you did not change. You did not become who you could have become as a consequence of that change. And worse, you have now taught yourself, by your own example, that such turning away is acceptable, and you are therefore more likely to commit the same error in the future. And what you failed to face is now larger. This is not the kind of causal process, the kind of positive feedback loop that you want to find yourselves trapped within. So you must confess, at least to yourself, and repent, at least within yourself, and you must change because you were wrong. And you must humbly ask and knock and seek. And that is the great barrier to the enlightenment of which we are all capable in principle. This is not to claim that the courage necessary to confront the full horrors of life is easy to muster, but the alternative is worse. It is our destiny to transform chaos into order. If the past has not been ordered, the chaos it still constitutes haunts us. There is information, vital information, resting in the memories that affect us negatively. It is as if part of the personality is still lying latent out in the world, making itself manifest only in emotional disruption. What is traumatic but remains inexplicable indicates that the map of the world that guides our navigation is insufficient in some vital manner. It is necessary to understand the negative well enough so that it can be circumvented as we move into the future if we do not wish to remain tormented by the past. And it is not the expression of emotion associated with unpleasant events that has curative power. It is the development of a sophisticated causal theory. Why was I at risk? What was it about the world that made it dangerous? What was I doing or not doing to contribute to my vulnerability? How can I change the value hierarchy I inhabit to take the negative into account so that I can see and understand it? How much of my old map do I have to let crumble and burn with all the pain dying tissue produces before I can change enough to take my full range of experience into account? Do I have the faith to step beyond what should and must die and let my new and wiser personality emerge? To some great degree, we are our assumptions. They structure the world for us. When basic axioms of faith are challenged, people are basically good, the foundation shakes and the walls crumble. We have every reason to avoid facing the bitter truth. But making what is and what was clear and fully comprehended can only protect us. If you are suffering from memories that will not stop tormenting you, there is possibility. Possibility that could be your very salvation, waiting there to be discovered. If old memories still upset you, write them down carefully and completely.